Nancy mentioned that the words from Srimad Bhagavatam that we discussed this morning touched on that topic also. Was it square on the topic, but it touched on the topic. And there's lots of things to be said about the topic. Circumstances like this, it would be easy to fly just. The message of Bhagavad Gita is kindness, wisdom, and it falls within a historical context, but aside from the historical context, the wisdom is eternal wisdom. In the beginning of the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that he spoke the same wisdom some, you know, billions of years ago. He spoke it to the sun god Devaswan, and Devaswan spoke it to his son Manu, Vaivasvata Manu. Manu spoke it to his son Ikshvaku. And Arjuna says, wait a minute, how's that possible? You spoke it to the sun god Devaswan. You weren't even around. I, of course, paraphrasing, you didn't use that language. But this is billions of years ago. And you weren't around. How can you say this? You spoke it to the sun god Devaswan. And Krishna says, many, many lives both you and I have passed, Arjuna. I can remember all of them, but you cannot. Arjuna, you were there too when I spoke this message to the sun god Vivaswan. Now, the historical context of this Bhagavad Gita is different. Krishna speaking to Arjuna on a battlefield, and we don't get indication of what the historical context was, you know, the social circumstance, but it's not likely it was the battlefield of Kurukshetra with thousands of soldiers on both sides. Krishna spoke transcendental knowledge to the sun god Vyaswan, historically different circumstance, but the principles are the same. The principles are timeless. And one of those timeless principles is understanding that the first message of transcendental knowledge that Krishna gives to Arjuna is the knowledge of the self being different than the covering of the gross and subtle bodies. I just circulated, someone sent an interview, because we're in Michigan, of great-grandson of Henry Ford, Ambarish Prabhu, disciple of Srila Prabhupada, was being interviewed, I think it was by Reuters Press or something like that. In any case, there was some part of the dialogue where the interviewer was asking Ambarish, the great-grandson of Henry Ford, would your father approve of the lifestyle that you're now living? And he said, I definitely would approve. He was a spiritual person. He was a vegetarian. And he was a firm believer in reincarnation. And those were his convictions. He'd be very happy and proud of me that I'm living my life according to the lifestyle that I'm doing just now. And then another question was, how did you begin? So he described something about how he began somebody he found or someone gave him or something like that, a Bhagavad Gita. It wasn't like he met somebody somewhere, it just kind of fell in his lap. And that's kind of how I got my first Bhagavad Gita, just someone gave me copies of Bhagavad Gita. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know even how to pronounce it. I didn't know anything. And then after reading Bhagavad Gita, Ambarish said, he very much wanted to meet the author because he had been examining different forms of spirituality, and this particularly resonated, answered so many questions. He was inspired. So an arrangement was made when Prabhupada was in Hawaii that he went to visit Prabhupada in Hawaii. And the introduction was made. He comes into the room where Prabhupada is there. And, you know, Prabhupada, this is the great-grandson of Henry Ford. And Prabhupada acknowledged and then said, so your great-grandfather is Henry Ford. Yes. And where is he now? That was like where the conversation began. Because normally, oh, you know, you're from an aristocratic something or other family. But right away, Srila Prabhupada went to the same message as Bhagavad Gita. Basically, you're not this body. So although the body may be born within the Ford family, you're not the body, and your great-grandfather is also not his body, and where does the soul go after this body? I mean, he did. It was just that one statement leads to that kind of level of consideration, contemplation. That the knowledge, transcendental knowledge, which is the topic I was asked to address, immediately, if it's to be received, or when it is received, it means it takes the lens through which you look at life to the platform of the eternal. It doesn't mean the temporary isn't around you, but the temporary that's around you doesn't necessarily have to be what you identify with. You work with it, you address it, you deal with it in a responsible and proper way, in service to the source of all that is temporary, and the source of all that is eternal, the Supreme, acting in consciousness of, I have a relationship with the Supreme. So I do the temporary in harmony with the will of the Supreme. And my goal is to be in harmony with the Supreme. So I'm dealing with the external and the internal simultaneously in contemplation of the Supreme. But if there isn't transcendental knowledge, you know, in the absence of transcendental knowledge, it's a condition of ajnana in Sanskrit. There's jnana, transcendental knowledge, and then there's ajnana, without transcendental knowledge. The prefix A is ajnana, without knowledge. So the English is ignorance. And when we're acting in ignorance, even actions that are done with good intention may be detrimental. I knew that when I was like 4 or 5 years old. Good intention can be lethal if you don't know what you're doing. Just a little anecdote, you know, a little boy. I thought of this because I saw there's locusts. There's a longer name for them. These little insects that are about, you know, that big and have like whole sets of wings, and they fly in swarms, and they come around every 13 years or something like that. I don't know how that cycle works. But when they come, it's like a cloud in the sky. They just swarm, and they land on trees, and they eat all the leaves, and you can hear them chomping away. And all the trees are barren. And then when all the trees are barren, they go to another place and eat all the leaves. And you don't see them again for another 13 years. So when I was young, it was one of those years. And my mother gave me a service of taking one of those plungers that had black flag inside, and you little pressure and spray a black flag comes out, spray it in the garage so we don't have locusts in the garage. So, sure. Spray, and there was our cat in the garage. So I didn't want the cat to get locusts, so I sprayed the cat. Next morning, the cat's dead in the garage. And I learned a lesson. To this day, still remember. Good intention isn't good enough. If you're acting with good intention in ignorance, it can be not good for you or others. So especially when, like one fellow was asking at the program last night at the university, it wasn't exactly his question, but it got into what's the purpose of this human form of life? There's a special facility. He was comparing himself and his dog, and why is it that I get a body of a human and my dog, he was a nice dog, but he gets the body of a dog. So the human form of life has its facility by design. You know, that the manufacturer, Krishna, through the agency of Lord Brahma, the creator of the universe, made the human form of life with this special faculty that we can discriminate. We can receive transcendental knowledge and then operate the machine, the material body, human form of life, towards, you know, with knowledge, with transcendental knowledge of who we are and what the source of everything is and what's the nature of that source of everything, and then acting accordingly in harmony with the Supreme, and even more than in harmony with the Supreme, in a relationship with the Supreme. I want to say a couple of the things. I thought this would probably be a group that conversation and questions and answers is probably much better than blah, blah, blah. You know, a lot of saying things. So I'm looking forward to some nice questions from all of you. Otherwise I'll go back to Bhagavad Gita if you don't. Two things. There's a little section in chapter 4 of Bhagavad Gita where Krishna describes something that's puzzling. He describes what he does, then he describes that I'm yet the non-doer. And, you know, that's a contradiction. He does and he's the non-doer. And similarly, for us, we had this little discussion in class yesterday. We do things, but we're the non-doer. We have a role to play. So there's a role. Transcendental knowledge says, Krishna says, never consider yourself to be the cause of action. Never consider yourself to be the cause of others' action, or never consider yourself to be creating the result of that action. Kind of like checkmate. And because all this is being carried out by material nature, it's not that we're a non-entity, we're just kind of like a non-entity being carried along for the ride, and whatever, you know, kesara sara, whatever it may be, will be. We have nothing to say about it or do about it. We have a role, but we're not the doer. Material nature is the doer, and then later in Bhagavad Gita, transcendental knowledge role says, there's five factors to action, one of them is us. We're not the doer, but we make some endeavor. Like, you know, supposing you make some endeavor that winter in Detroit is going to be 75 degrees. Well, you can endeavor like that, but it's not going to happen. Or you endeavor to become a millionaire, you don't become a millionaire or something. You endeavor to become a gold medalist in an Olympic team, and you may not. You make some endeavor, and then there's other factors. There's Krishna's sanction, there's material nature, there's the instruments of action. So there's multiple factors, and if any one of them is absent, like take the living entity out of this body, and then action doesn't happen, but put the living entity in the body and the living entity makes some endeavor, then something may happen. But it's no guarantee, because we're not causing things to be done. Material nature is the cause of action, the cause of the result of the action, and the cause of inducing others to act. We have a role to play, but it's not the doer. Transcendental knowledge teaches us kartaham iti manyate. Acting through false ego means karta means to do, or the doer. Aham is me, I. Aham, first person singular. Kartaham iti manyate. Thus thinking, I am the doer. This is acting through false ego. We're discussing a little bit on the way over here about Brahma Samhita, the first section of Brahma Samhita. Fascinating, very complicated, but one of the things, it's the process of creation. So rather than just say, God said, let there be creation, and so it was, and it was good. It's true, but there's like steps and steps and steps and steps, you know, slow motion photography kind of. And that slow motion picture is described in Brahma Samhita. And one of the steps in that slow motion is by the glance of Mahavishnu, who sees this field of undifferentiated material energy. Pradhan is the Sanskrit term. He glances at that pradhan, understanding this energy of mine wishes to have some service to me. Let me give this energy of mine some opportunity to do some service. Just by that glance, the living entity contacts that pradhan, like the primordial impregnation. Brahma Samhita and the Bhagavatam describes. And when the impregnation takes place, the living entity is sent forth, the undifferentiated material elements, a cloud of material energy, becomes agitated. And when agitated, the elements start to separate out. They were undifferentiated before. And the first one that separates out is false ego. And it goes further. False ego then mixes with the modes of nature. When false ego mixes with the mode of goodness, the material mind separates out. When false ego mixes with the mode of passion, material intelligence separates out. When false ego mixes with the mode of ignorance, the five gross elements separate out. And then from the five gross elements, the senses, working senses, knowledge acquiring senses, and the objects of the senses. It's really active over there in that mode of ignorance department. So there's 24 elements that even before the living entity has a body to do anything and think, I'm the doer, before that happens, there's false ego. And false ego covers the living entity. And then we have our dear companion, false ego. Then it gets details. You know, whether it's a Ford or a Lincoln or a Toyota. You know, what's the chassis going to look like? What species of life do we get? What are the features of that species of life, subtle and gross? Before we even get a covering, there's false ego that covers us. And then we operate from that paradigm of false ego, thinking, I'm the doer, I'm going to get things done, I'm going to get other people to do things. And Krishna says, no, don't think like that. It's not so. That's ignorance. Here's knowledge. Material nature does it all, and I oversee material nature. That's us. And then there's Krishna. So I want to read three verses from chapter 4, Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna describes similarly about himself. It's transcendental knowledge to understand, you know, the answer to that question. Hey, what's going on? You know that one. why are things the way that they are? So, chapter 4, verse 13, 14, 15. I'll read 15 first. This is like where the discussion is headed. All liberated souls in ancient times acted with this understanding of my transcendental nature. Therefore, you should perform your duty following their footsteps. So there's the means to get there. You know, when you get on the train of transcendental knowledge, what's the last station? Where does the train take you? It takes you to the platform of not being bound by ignorance, and acting in ignorance causes suffering, and the bondage of karmic activity, thinking I'm going to do it and I'm going to enjoy the fruits of what I do. That's the material conception of life that transcendental knowledge can illumine. Remove the material conception and replace it with a spiritual conception. Then I can act in knowledge and by this method be liberated from the bondage of material existence. It's subtle, but it's pretty helpful. Men in this world desire success in fruitive activities. So, what's fruitive activities? It's activities that are done with the consciousness of false ego. I'm going to do, because I do, I'm going to generate a result, and then I'm going to enjoy the result, the fruit of my work. And so men in this world, they like fruitive work. How many people go to their jobs without getting paid? Not too many. There are volunteer workers, but what does it mean to be not attached to the fruits of your work but still work? Well, Krishna gives his own example to help us understand how we can act. Text 13, chapter 4. According to the three modes of material nature, I've already mentioned those three modes. Goodness leads to elevation. Passion is where we are, where it's fruit of activities. And ignorance is darkness. Three modes of nature, like the three primary colors, yellow, red, and blue, mixed make all colors. Three modes of nature, mixed makes all varieties. Very same, very similar model. I mean, if you wanted to be a creator, makes it easy. Just have three modes of nature and mix them. According to the three modes of material nature and the work associated with them, so work associated with the mode of goodness includes, it's described in the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, but things like cleanliness, truthfulness, compassion, honesty, interest in knowledge, in transcendental knowledge particularly, regulation in activity. There are symptoms of the quality of goodness. So when goodness is operating in someone's life, those are behaviors moved by or impelled by the mode of goodness. Passion, strive to get a result. Work hard, achieve, accomplish, get the carrot, keep striving and endeavoring in that way. Control.
Maharaj, but when Krishna says this, Arjuna is fighting the war for the fruits of this,
that's not what he's fighting. He's doing without attachment to the result. Can you hold the question till the end? Is that right?
Right.
Okay, thanks. And mode of ignorance has other symptoms, moroseness, laziness, lethargy, sleep, madness, indolence, lamentation. mode of ignorance. So there's three modes. And the previous part is men desire to enjoy through fruitive activities. So according to the modes of nature and the work associated with them, there's divisions of human society which Krishna says, I have created. And although I'm the creator of the system, you should know that I'm yet the non-doer, being unchangeable. So it's an interesting verb, what he does, but he doesn't do. He does, in Krishna's case, he doesn't do because he does, things are done through the agency of his potencies. Like, he didn't have to even lift a pinky. He just desires, and his energies do, understanding what he wishes, like Genesis in the Bible says, God said, let there be, and so it was, let there be light. He didn't even have to say it. He just wills it, the Sanskrit term is icha, and the potencies of the Lord, innumerable and inconceivable potencies, they act according to his will. So he's the doer in the sense that he wills, but he's the non-doer in the sense that his energies are doing things. Because I am avyayam, unchangeable. For us to do something, we, you know, like I said, just like go to the kitchen. I have to stand up, walk across the room, open the door, you know, I have to do stuff or something. And there's changes that are part of that. When Krishna does, he doesn't change. It's his nature. And it's part of transcendental knowledge to understand his nature. Then he says, text 14, there is no work that affects me, nor do I aspire for the fruits of action. One who understands this truth about me also does not become entangled in fruitive reactions of work. Which, you know, connects with the question that you started to ask about Arjuna. But you know, whether it's Arjuna or you or me, or anyone that's functioning according to the indications here of Bhagavad Gita, there's prescribed duties according to our nature. Bhagavad Gita language speaks like this. Each of us has a body, and according to the body and the modes of nature associated with that body, there's some work that's suited for us. Some people are suited for intellectual work, some people are suited for administrative work, some people are suited for production and trade and commerce, and some persons are suited for other types of work, according to our nature. So we act according to our nature. We act according to our nature. At the same time that the indication of Bhagavad Gita is to turn our attention to our consciousness to the Supreme. So we work for the Supreme, for Krishna. That's what Arjuna did. He was a Kshatriya, meaning Kshatriyas have that spirit of passion to protect and to give direction to others, and if necessary, you know, exercise in heroism to do that which is for protection and the well-being and the principles of the well-being of society. They're leaders, so there's the mode of passion is operating in that circumstance. So the mode of nature is not something to be avoided. It's something that we recognize, and then we act according to that mode of nature and utilize that in the service to Krishna according to our nature. And that creates a situation, according to Bhagavad Gita's teaching, where there isn't karma generated. What's karma that's generated? It's the opposite. Karma, the seed for karma being generated is, I'm attached to the results of my work. and I do things because I want something, and then I'm implicated in the karmic bondage. So they'll go the other direction. The alternative is to recognize I have a certain nature, to act according to my nature, and take guidance from teachings and teachers, what is my nature, and offer that to the Supreme as a sacrifice to Krishna. So when one does that, there isn't bondage, and suddenly Krishna is saying, no, that person unto whom you're offering things, understand his nature, understand Krishna's nature. He's also, you know, in the position of the source of everything, and in one sense, therefore, also the controller of his energies, but he's the non-doer. And one who understands that about him is free from bondage of work. They're not even aspiring for being the enjoyer of the fruits of their work. They simply wish to be engaged in service. And the outcome of that service is in Krishna's hand. And they're happy with that situation. Because that's just reality, it's the way things are. The third verse, I hope I'm getting this message across. Third verse, text 15. All the greatest souls in ancient times acted with this understanding of my transcendental nature. Therefore, you should perform your duty following in their footsteps. I just read the first sentence of the purport that gives a hint of what's coming. There are two classes of men. Some of them are full of polluted material things within their hearts, and some of them are materially free. If we understand the nature of the transcendental nature of Krishna, and we can understand the transcendental nature of who we are, and here we are, we're in this ocean of material energy. I mean, any direction you look, up, down, sideways, there's material energy. We're in this ocean of material energy, and we're not material energy. We're spiritual energy. We're in a foreign place. We really don't belong here. We belong in the spiritual energy, spiritual atmosphere. But here we are. So now, while we're here, let us recognize where this energy comes from. Of course, we can't kind of sort it out on our own. It has to come in this descending fashion. That's how transcendental knowledge comes. And then we can operate as a spiritual entity in a material atmosphere, recognizing that especially this human form of life is meant for that position of self-realization, realizing who we really are, and realizing self-realization implies, implicit, is realization of the connection that we have with the source of who we are and where we've come from. That's transcendental knowledge. And when we act in transcendental knowledge, that ignorance is removed. And when ignorance is removed, there's a natural happiness of the soul. Krishna describes the happiness of transcendental life is a happiness from within. And because that happiness is from within, it naturally, that radiates out if there's happiness within. You know, in our interactions with others, and all these other features of the quality of goodness, compassion towards others, the sense of concern and well-being for others. Just before coming, and end with this, just before coming, I was spending time reading and actually editing a message about Grandfather Bhishma. So for those of you that are not from India, you don't know who Grandfather Bhishma is. But the two personalities in Bhagavad Gita, one is Krishna and the other is Arjuna. And Arjuna is amongst five brothers, they're extremely virtuous, and they're the epitome, the picture of virtue. They would never do something that's outside of what is virtuous. and they're guided by persons who know the difference. And one of the persons that guided them was their grandfather, because their father died when they were very young, so they were raised primarily by their grandfather, Bhishma. And Bhishma, there's a section of the Bhagavatam where Bhishma is lying on a battlefield. Literally, his body is pierced through so many times with arrows that he's not even lying on the ground, he's lying on a bed of arrows. You know, the arrow going in this side and out the other side, and he's lying on the bed of arrows. But he's this kind of mystic yogi where he could continue to live even that with the circumstance. Certainly there was pain, but he was able to transcend the pain because his consciousness was at a higher place. And because he was such an exalted personality, kings and sages came from all over the place just, you know, to be with him as he was leaving his body. And as they came, he was so cultured that he wanted to receive them, but he couldn't even get up and, you know, make any arrangement for them. But because of his culturedness, the way that he spoke, they all were completely satisfied. Of course, they felt bad about his condition, but as far as, you know, the culture of receiving others, it's a very important part of a life of goodness, is receiving others in a proper way. And after receiving them, he then sees that these five Pandavas, you know, Arjuna and his four brothers, so the five brothers, and seeing them, he starts to cry, because he feels such compassion for the difficulties they had to endure throughout their lives. You know, details some of the things that the endurances. He said, most people would never even have been able to live through these difficulties that you've been through. So here he is, dying on a battlefield. Who can imagine the immense amount of pain his body was in? And he's just feeling for the well-being of others that have been through difficulty. It's pretty amazing. The quality of compassion is just a natural byproduct of the consciousness, when it's consciousness that's fixed in transcendence. Now we have our little social and, you know, physical problems. We stub our toe and somebody says something mean to us, and we feel pain and we feel hurt. So one who becomes fixed in transcendental consciousness transcends duality. Doesn't mean he can't recognize there's arrows in his body, or there's pain where those arrows are. But one can, by spiritual strength, by spiritual connection in transcendental life, there's a strength that enables one to to deal with the dualities of material existence, whether it's going in this direction or that direction. Because the material world is a place of duality. Sometimes this, and sometimes that, and always changing. Actually, this is a little different. I'm going to end because I said I would end. Tomorrow I'm going to New York, and I'll be speaking on Harinam Chintamani. It's a wonderful literature that describes the power of the holy name, because we're all engaged in the chanting of Krishna's holy name and hearing Krishna's message from Bhagavad Gita. And the influence of ignorance similarly is discussed in Harinam Chintamani, where even the practice we do, aside from how we live our lives and interact with the circumstances of life, just, you know, the root of elevating of our consciousness, especially for this age, is the chanting of the holy name. The scriptures teach us, and our experience tells us it's true. But when ignorance blocks that power of the holy name. It blocks the power of spirituality when we misidentify the self as something that we're not and hold on to it. And then, you know, there's different varieties of that, but the spiritual principle is our true spiritual identity. And transcendental knowledge is very, very essential in chanting, because otherwise the effect of chanting is going to be diminished. The example is given in Harinam Chintamani, like the shining of the sun that's blocked by clouds or mist. The sun is still shining, it's not night, but we don't get the full effect of the sunshine if there's fog or mist or clouds. And ignorance is compared to the mist, and offenses is compared to clouds. It's more dense. So I'll be discussing that, not tonight. But it's related to, you know, what I understand Deva Madhava wanted me to speak about. The chanting of the holy name, or contact anything that's genuinely spiritual. We don't get the full effect of that something that's genuinely spiritual if there's the clouds and mist. So the holy name may be rising in your heart, but you won't experience the fullness of that where there's clouds and mist, or the covering of ignorance and offenses. To be continued in New York. Harinam Chintamani. You can read chapter 3 of Harinam Chintamani if you like. It's discussed there. It's very nice, very, very clear. Any discussion or comments?
There's this idea that's kind of gone around past few years that the more you meditate on something, then you'll attract that into your life. It's like sort of this metaphysical groups talk about. Yes, yeah. So sounds like that would be inaccurate from your analysis, where you're talking about the 5 factors of action.
Why would it cancel it out?
Well, that you were saying, because the...
We're not the doer, but there has to be, if there's a sanction.
Yeah, the sanction would...
Well, it can't happen without sanction, but the sanction could be sanctioned. The sanctioner is the Lord of the Heart. And if the Lord of the Heart sees we have this fascination or attraction or obsession or whatever for something, then, you know, it can make a connection. One doesn't discount the other. Am I missing something?
Well, it's like your karma, like, you know, if you're...
Well, it's not necessarily going to happen, but it can happen. It's more likely to happen than otherwise, unless it is just your karma just falls from the sky. But there's karmically, there's a reason. There's reasons why. There's both ignorance and aparad have an influence to repeat themselves. So if I'm meditating on something out there, as you're describing, fair chance that there's something back there that's the impetus for me to meditate on that something that's out there. I did it before. Or some other kinds of factors that are impelling me to meditate on something that's out there. It's pushing me, because we're conditioned by guna and karma, the modes of nature and our past activity. Now we have an option, we have a free will option to, you know, change the channel. And one of the best ways to change the channel is to make spiritual impressions that can penetrate through that material conditioning. There may be things to deal with the material conditioning, but spiritual practice that can penetrate through that covering to say the least, it's very helpful. You could say it's stronger, it's essential. To actually change the picture. Without a spiritual core, it's a matter of adjusting the shadow. You know, here's the light, here's my hand, here's the shadow. I can try to adjust the shadow, but you know, you have to move the object, that changes where the shadow is. And the light's constant. So that's, you know, the consciousness of the soul, and then there's, you know, the coverings of the soul, and there's like the shape of my life and things that happen in my life because of that, the coverings, the good and the karma, and things happen in Krishna sanctions, and then I, you know, I do what I do, I interact with the shape of things the way that my intelligence says to do so, the modes of nature that impel me. And we're like on a machine. So, the statement that I made doesn't discount this other thing that you said. Doesn't nullify it.
But I think that what he's saying is in the law of attraction there's no sanctioner. Like they don't talk about that. They just say if you...
Oh. Well, because we're students of Bhagavad Gita, we do. But to say that there's a sanctioner doesn't rule out the other.
Yeah, they sort of say like, you want to achieve something, you meditate on that, and eventually, then it'll come to you kind of mystically.
Well, maybe it will, maybe it won't. Depends on the sanctioning. I mean, supposing I want to be, if you use some of those other examples, I want to be a millionaire, or I want to be a gold medalist.
Right, yeah. That's...
I gotta prioritize my life like anything to discipline myself to become a gold medalist. But I may not be number one. And to become number one, it's more than just, you know, my discipline. There's a sanction. That's our Vedic conception, at least. So one doesn't nullify the other. Way in the back, yeah. I bet you can project your voice a little louder.
Okay. With the living entity, you spoke a little bit about action and inaction, or, you know, being controlled by the modes of nature.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you could share a little more light on where you take responsibility and where you're understanding that it's, that you don't necessarily, you know, like that's by the control of the modes of material.
Okay.
Because it's so easy to say, well, I'm not responsible.
I'm not responsible. It's just the modes are operating in case or else or not. Well, yeah, what we're responsible for is our choices, not the outcomes of those choices. So we're consciousness. The operative principle that we're responsible for is consciousness. We make conscious choices. Now, when I'm making conscious choices, let's just say, supposing I don't even know the difference between, like I did when I was a little boy, I didn't know the difference between, you know, putting black flag in the garage and putting black flag on the cat. That was an ignorance. But, you know, I'm responsible for the choice of doing that, even though it was an ignorance. And I wasn't impelled to do it, but I did it. So I felt really bad. And, you know, the cat felt really bad, too.
Not the law.
Huh?
Not the law.
Yeah.
Maybe.
But, well, so back to your question. We take responsibility for our choices, and, you know, if my consciousness is not illumined, even with good intention, I'm going to make mistakes. Now, that tells me I need to take responsibility for being illumined, you know, having proper knowledge of how to act, what's to be done and what's not to be done. I'm still going to make mistakes because I'm an imperfect being, but at least what I'm responsible for is becoming informed and acting rightly. So then the outcome, that's that's out of my hand. Yeah? I mean, think about what you're trying to do here. You and your husband are trying to do in, with this Krishna house. Your responsibility is the choices that you make and the conscious efforts that you expend, and not, you know, at the sacrifice of your own sadhana and your own well-being, because that's easy to do that one, but, you know, so that you can actually give something of value, you have to do it. So, make wise choices. And then interact with people in their different circumstances of life. It gets really colorful out there. And, you know, do your best to assist them in their path of, you know, of their spiritual well-being and as it's appropriate, their material well-being and so forth. And you're responsible to make those, become educated and wise about how to guide. And an essential part of how to guide is to be guided and to receive before you can give. So we are that the Krishna channel receiver has to be on, like all the time, to be guided, and others, persons who are similarly connected to Krishna guiding us, and then we can be more effective, and that's what we're responsible for. And the outcome is, that's in Krishna's hand. That's the part we don't have control over. But we have control over where we direct our consciousness and becoming as qualified as we can as life unfolds to do our activity properly. That's our responsibility.
Thanks.
Yes.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So, a question arised when you mentioned that, to paraphrase, that we're a spiritual being in a human existence. That's kind
yeah.
of a
paraphrase. Yeah, that's good.
But that's foreign, but yet there was choice for us to come here. Whether you want to call it karmic or whatever you want, there was choice for that spirit to come here. So how is that foreign?
But it's foreign in this sense. Relying upon the wisdom that comes from Bhagavad Gita, the atmosphere in which it is natural for us is to be in a spiritual atmosphere as opposed to the temporary and impermanent material atmosphere. There is such an atmosphere that was natural for us. Comparison is given like a fish out of water. And then whatever amenities you may give to the fish, he's not going to be happy unless he's in his natural habitat, in the water. Similarly, our natural atmosphere, the soul's natural atmosphere, is to be in the spiritual realm. That's what's natural for us. So, yes, there's some, one can indicate how we got here, now that we're here. It's we make the best use of it, but the understanding is it's temporary, and it's not natural for the soul to be here. What's natural for the soul is to be in the spiritual atmosphere, like a fish in water. Similarly, so it's not escapism. It's recognizing that there's discomfort here because by nature it's not natural for us. So we make the best use of it. It's God's energy. And we can utilize God's energy in service to God as best we can. And if He wants us to continue on, you know, in an infinite number of lifetimes, so be it. But after the hankering, the soul's natural hankering, is to be essentially being in that loving relationship with the Supreme. Mm-hmm. And we can certainly do that here if He so desires.
If we desire,
just like this other mentioned, if we desire, sure. But it's the spiritual atmosphere is very natural. I mean, something like, what's a medical doctor without people that have disease? You know, he's got nothing to do, twiddle his thumbs. So, if we like service, you know, certainly there's lots of service here. lots of opportunities to be in service to other living entities who are parts of the Supreme. That's nice. At the same time, the teaching is the atmosphere is unnatural for us. So we can stay here in service, no problem. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, maybe you've heard his name in the course of interacting with devotees, his teaching is like that. If you wish, I can, birth after birth. Mama Jamani Jamanishwari Bhavatad Bhakti Rahaita Kitwain. I simply wish to be engaged in your service. So, if you so desire, but birth after birth. So what I'm looking for from you in my relationship with you is not get me out of here, but what I'm looking for you is this service.
See, that was my question, if our soul is in harmony when it's in the spiritual realm, then why bother with this existence?
Well, in part because we're here and there's service to be done. So if Krishna so desires, he can engage me lifetime after lifetime in whatever the situation, here or wherever he wants me to go. That's a very elevated condition. So for those of us that aren't in such an elevated condition, it's actually recommended desire to be with Krishna and in that spiritual atmosphere. But if Krishna so desires, fine. Service, because the main thing is service to him. You had something. You had your hand up before. I don't know your name. You were raising your hand before.
No.
Okay. You have. You're enthusiastic.
Maharaj, I was just wondering, at the end of the Mahabharata, what happens is the Pandavas go to hell. I mean, hell for temporarily, and the Kauravas go to heaven or something, right? Why would that development happen?
Well, are you familiar with the difference between Srimad Bhagavatam and Mahabharata? Because you're asking a technical question that doesn't relate to some of the people that are here. But I'll answer your question because you asked the question. Mahabharata falls in the category of itihasa, right? Histories, itihasa. And Srimad Bhagavatam falls in the category of purana. And amongst the Puranas, it's Amala Purana, Spotless Purana. You familiar with those two terms? Yes? A little bit.
Yeah, I've heard the terms.
Okay, just listen carefully. So, you're familiar with the modes of nature. Modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. And what Krishna says in chapter 14 of Bhagavad Gita is, if goodness is prominent, there's also a mix of passion and ignorance. If passion is prominent, there's also a mix of goodness and ignorance. If ignorance is prominent, there's a mix of goodness and passion. Right? And they're competing for supremacy. Correct? So, the Puranas and the Itihasas have a mix. Some modes of nature mix. The Srimad Bhagavatam is described by them as being spotless, having no mix. That's pure goodness. Pure goodness means transcendental, no mix of the modes of nature. You with me so far? Okay. So the message in the Srimad Bhagavatam, what it says, what happens when Krishna departs, is the Pandavas return, they go with Krishna, because the Pandavas are eternal associates of Krishna, and wherever Krishna is, the Pandavas are. Wherever he performs his Bhauma Leela, his earthly pastimes, who's with him? Pandavas. Always. Always. Not sometimes, always. Because they're his eternal associates. So when Krishna goes, they go with Krishna. So that's like the Supreme Court. Then there's a lower court over here. That's teaching moralities. And if you make a mistake, you're responsible for your mistake. And so each of the Pandavas made this and that and the other mistake. Because just live in the world and you're going to make mistakes. So they were responsible for their mistakes, even though they were elevated persons. So the message there in Mahabharata is about morality. You're a good person, you're still responsible for your mistakes, if you're a good person. And the message of the Bhagavatam is teaching the aspiration of unmixed devotion for the Supreme. And those that have, like the Pandavas, have unmixed devotion for the Supreme, even they make mistakes, like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you're familiar, chapter 9, Apichat Sudaracharo, 933, go home and look it up, 933. Even if you make a big boo-boo.
You said that name of yesterday, Krishna comes and corrects
it. Got it. Got it. You got it. That's Krishna's message in Bhagavad Gita. But there's a condition. Bhajate mam ananyabhak. Bhajate mam ananyabhak. Undivided devotion unto Krishna. Krishna steps in, cleans you up, dusts you off, sets you on your way again. He steps in and corrects the situation personally. Is that right? Okay. Anything else back there? Yes.
On Tuesday, thank you for speaking.
Huh?
Thank you for speaking. On Tuesday, you said fruits of piety plus an impure heart equals
pride.
And that seems kind of inevitable.
Yeah.
So how to get rid of the pride after it happens?
Well, go back. To the root, and that you make the heart clean. That's the best. And it takes a while. It takes, striving by right means, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. Consistently, that's sadhana. Consistently striving by right means, making the heart pure. Cheto darpanam arjanam. That's the how you make the heart pure. By coming in contact with something that's supremely pure, we can become pure. We do need to do it regularly, because it's like not just a little layer of dust in the heart, it's pretty thick. So that's the best. Now your question was, when pride does result, what to do?
Mm-hmm.
How to clean it up? Well, remain humble as the antidote for pride. Recognizing that there is this tendency. So let me apply something on the other side of the pan scale, that is, at least try to be humble and associate with persons that have that quality. They can acknowledge their mistakes when they do something out of pride, and I like being with those people, because then I can imbibe that quality too. A good association, and the scrubbing program, making the heart clean. Okay. Yeah.
You spoke on mistakes, and that in such an instance where a mistake, we make mistakes, that Krishna would come and fix such a thing. How you would adjust? Is this fair?
He adjusts. Our heart, primarily, and not necessarily, but maybe also the circumstance.
Within that, then, is it not a happening that is of Krishna unto itself, and therefore a mistake not, that it is perhaps experiential for the lesson, and that the choice is part of the happening?
Sure. But then, once the lesson is learned, then what? Next. Supposing I step on your foot. Yeah. And I could say, like what the Mataji said, oh, it was just meant to be. Don't worry about the pain in your foot. I don't take responsibility for stepping on your foot. But better I stepped on your foot, and I take responsibility for stepping on your foot. I'm sorry. Can I do something to make your foot feel better? No, it's okay. It doesn't hurt that much. Let me step on your foot, no. Anyway, then you have some choices to make. But we take responsibility for our actions. Don't just like, you know, you have something?
No.
Yes.
Hi, I'm a novice to the Hare Krishna movement, but if you allow me to elaborate, I think that you'll be able to ascertain what it is I'm trying to convey.
Okay, that's a pretty good warm-up. Prelude.
Okay, well, if you ask who trained Dr. Sigmund Freud of Vienna, you would find that it was Mesmer.
It was who?
Mesmer. Mesmer, he was the one who hypnotized, and Mesmer mystified, and Mesmer mesmerized. And at that time, there were people who would lie on the hospital floors for as much as a month if they knew that Mesmer was coming. But
Mesmer was a powerful guy, huh?
Right, but his protege was the one who was the patriarch of the field of psychiatry.
Freud. He was a student or a friend or what?
He was his patriarch. I'm not his patriarch, but his novice. Not his novice, but his protocol. I'm not his protocol, but his protege.
Protege. His buddy.
Yeah.
His buddy.
He was his protege.
Okay, fine.
But now,
so we got two people now, Freud and Mesmer.
Right.
And Mesmer is mesmerizing people.
Right. Now, Freud, what he did was he established the id, the ego, and the superego. Okay. Now, I heard you mention a false ego.
Yeah, I did.
But now, I was wondering if Krishna consciousness acknowledges a spiritual entity known as the alter ego.
Once upon a time, I was in college. And when I was in college, one of the things I was interested in was, you know, Carl Jung and Sigmund Freud. But it's been so long that I would give you a really uneducated, dumb response to your question. So I don't want to do that. So I'd have to, like, you know, think very carefully what alter ego is. In the technical sense of what, when people use that word, what do they mean? Not what do I think it means. So I'd rather, like, not respond until I could check up on what that means. Rather, you're trying to educate me right now what it means. So please don't, let's not go there.
All right.
What are the stratifications of personality?
Huh?
What are the stratifications of personality? Like, when a Krishna conscious person says false ego and real ego, what do we mean by that?
What do we mean by that? That's what you're, is that feeding off of his question?
Yes, that's trying to.
Trying to.
Parlay.
Well, real ego is real easy. And, false ego is very complicated. The real ego, in simple language, is that A and B. A is, we are a spark of conscious energy as the spark has relationship with the fire. So we as a conscious spark of life, we have a relationship with the supreme entity, and that relationship is a relationship of loving service, and there's varieties of that loving service according to different moods of love, and there's a whole science found in nectar devotion about that science of rasa, the kinds of loving relationships with the supreme. So that's the true ego. But it starts with, you know, same as chapter 2 Bhagavad Gita, we're not the body, we are that spark of life within, and the spark is conscious and is part of the supreme and so forth. That's true ego. And then the complex thing is the false ego is we forget who we are and instead identify with who we aren't. And who we aren't is the covering of the soul, both gross and subtle. So the gross covering is the gross body, and the subtle covering is mind, intelligence, and false ego. So if we identify with them in different mixtures and different modes of nature according to our different karmas, it gets really complex. So, and then that's what the action of false ego is. We forget who we really are, And if we get a relation with the Supreme, it's twofold. And then we adopt another identity in terms of the coverings, and then we make up our lives and our identities fulfilling that one. That's the false ego one. It gets really complicated. And, you know, by law of karma, when we do something, we get a reaction for that something, and that something comes back. The reaction. Yeah.
So Maharaj, can we say that
faith, okay.
Faith, does that signify whether it's a true ego or a false ego?
One can have faith in something that's misdirected.
So that will be a false ego?
Well, it depends if whether it's properly directed or misdirected. And what, so now, big question, what's the standard for that one? Who's going to decide that one?
But if your belief says that there is somebody who is superior to you, either a guru or God, then won't that signify a true ego?
Well, not necessarily, because I could think, I don't know, King Tut is, you know, where I should direct my allegiance or whatever. I maybe that principle of subservience to something greater than me can be misdirected. No. So in chapter 12, Krishna says, Arjuna asks Krishna a question, not chapter 12. Arjuna asks Krishna a question. If people don't have faith in you, won't they have faith in something else instead of you? No, implied is, isn't faith in something that's of the soul? And Krishna says, yes, the visions of faith. If they don't have faith in, they're going to have faith according to the modes of nature. So someone may have faith in, I don't know,
America.
Donald Trump.
So full faith is a bona fide spiritual tradition.
Huh?
Faith in a bona fide spiritual tradition.
But then, you know, sorry to repeat myself, but supposing I have an idea of a bona fide something or other, and it's not a bona fide something or other. So it has to be guided with proper knowledge. Now, again, who's going to decide that one? So there has to be some pramana. You're familiar with the Sanskrit word. Some means of proof, some means of valid knowledge. Like, you know, if I want to know if the American Airlines flight tomorrow is going to be on time, I don't go ask the guy at the gas station or the fellow that's passing by the street. They may know something about something else, but there's a valid source of knowledge about the American Airlines flights. They call up the travel agent or, you know, the whatever, the customer service people, because they're the source of valid knowledge about that. So what's the valid knowledge about this other one? A Purusheya Shanta is the proper source. It's a long discussion. We just spent 35 hours talking about it in New Jersey over Thanksgiving weekend.
New Jersey.
The fact that I look to something as higher, is that's good, but then it has to be properly guided. It could be misguided. Good intention, that's misguided. So then again, who's going to determine that? There has to be some source of valid knowledge. That's pramana or epistemology, a means of knowing something. Something's cooking inside. What's cooking?
So it means that if you have the right desire, it means you are in the mode of goodness, but you need to...
Not necessarily. I could have this. I mean, you know, I sprayed the cat with black flag. It was misguided. Desire was, you know, do something good for the cat, but I killed the cat. And I learned a big lesson. Besides, you know, don't put black flag on cats. You know, the principle. Knowledge, good intention has to be properly guided.
So how does this all come together? Someone has to guide you, right?
Yeah. So recognizing that I need someone to guide me, that's a good step, because most people are, you know, especially in America, I want my freedom. But it's not just America. You know, anywhere. We're in this material world because of rebellion towards the Supreme. And, you know, to say, okay, I want to be in harmony with the Supreme, but then here's the Supreme. No. I've got my own idea. Anyway, so how do you put it all together was your question. That there's, as Krishna says in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, there's a system of descending knowledge. You just connect with that system of descending knowledge. Okay, well, how do I find the system of descending knowledge? Well, there's symptoms of it. He describes what those symptoms are. It's just like supposing we had, you know, 10 electrical wires running across the floor and only one of them is plugged into the socket and they paid their electric bill. So you can touch the other end of the other 9 that aren't plugged into the socket. Is nothing going to happen? It may look just like the other one. So the actual unbroken line of disciplic succession, according to the teaching of Bhagavad Gita, is essential. Then that's how you pull it all together. And then there has to be willingness to receive that which is being delivered. You sound like you're willing to receive. You want that, you know, proper guidance.
Everybody wants it.
The reason we're here is we're rebellious. That's what everyone is. Some are more willing to receive than others. Yes?
I'm also a novice with Krishna consciousness, so forgive me if I'm not, you know, right on the money on this. As I'm reading about Krishna consciousness, there's this idea that's talked about that everything in the universe is an expansion of the Supreme Personality.
Fantastic, you got it.
But there are other teachings that you read, and you'll sort of get sort of New Agey type people saying, like, oh, I'm one with that tree, or I'm one with that river, or like everything, which, to my understanding, is considered by Krishna consciousness to be Mayavadi, to be incorrect.
That's correct.
So what is the distinction between that and the teaching that everything?
Well, there's a big difference. One of the big differences is, what is the source of everything? And then another big difference is recognizing that according to the teaching of Bhagavad Gita and Vedic wisdom, is that source is a person who has unlimited potencies, one of which is the tree and the river. And those potencies are from the source. That's the big difference. So to be one with could mean, you know, being in harmony with, or not being in conflict with, say the negative, not being in conflict with the natural design of the source for the, you know, his energies. So let me be in harmony and not in conflict with that will, the harmonious arrangement. I'll say one more sentence. I'm trying to say one more sentence. the concept of person or Bhagavan includes that person has potencies, unlimited and inconceivable potencies. If you say no, but that's something that source is less than. He cannot have this. So the Bhagavan conception is, yeah, oh yes, he can. And in fact, he does. So acknowledging those potencies, then that tells us how we lead our life in relation to the tree and the river and, you know, other people and and everything. That's the harmony part. Now I've been in, I'm in, I don't lose my individuality when I do that. Nor do I expect you to lose yours. We interact with one another as individuals to individuals, respecting individuality. Why? Because it's part of this grand orchestration of the Supreme. Let us be in harmony. That's easier said than done, but that's you know, the capacity to do that comes from a connection with the Supreme Person. At least we can do our part to be in harmony with the Supreme. All right? Okay. I think we're going to end with a kirtan.